It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Geraldine Brooks. Trained as a journalist, all of her novels draw on historical events as they carry us into a richly imagined past. Her latest novel, Caleb's Crossing, is now out in paperback. It was inspired by the first Native American to graduate from Harvard College way back in 1665. Hello, Geraldine.
Hello, it's wonderful to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And tell me when you first learned about this man, Caleb Chishatamok.
That was when I was on vacation on Martha's Vineyard, and I wanted to learn more about the Wampanoag tribe who have been on the island for millennia. And I happened across a map that the tribe had prepared showing sites of significance, and with all the tribal place names and historical notes. And there was a note saying that the town near we were staying was the birthplace of the first Native American graduate of Harvard. And I thought, that's so cool. I wonder if I'll run into him at the library one day. And I hadn't actually realized that the date of his graduation was 1665. So once I found out that this had taken place so early in the period of first contact, really, between Wampanoag and English settlers, that I wanted to know more about how it could have come to pass that a young man raised in his own language and culture had wound up learning Latin and been able to sit down and study with the sons of the colonial elite at Harvard.
Well, take us back in time to the 17th century, to when Caleb would have been a young man on Martha's Vineyard, what we now call Martha's Vineyard. What was the landscape like?
The landscape was probably not all that dissimilar. I mean, the island is about one-third developed now, so obviously it wouldn't have had all these fancy summer houses, but there was a tiny struggling settlement of English colonists who'd come across in 1641, but there are only a dozen or so families of English and about 3,000 Wampanoag who had been living very successfully on the island, knowing how to take advantage of its bounty in terms of the fish and game that the island provides in abundance. So they were a very fit and healthy and thriving tribe.
In the novel, you describe what brought the colonists to the island. Is that based on history?
Yeah, I was really curious to know, why would you have come here in 1641, putting 7 miles of tricky ocean current between yourself and the mainland and everybody else who shared your culture and what have you? And the answer was quite interesting. The band of English who came across to the island were trying to get out from under the heavy boot of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, because the colonists had come across the ocean on a tide of desire for religious freedom, but had very quickly decided not to advance it to anybody else. So the place had become quite Taliban-like in its insistence on only one possible doctrine, and anybody who veered away from the Massachusetts Bay Colony's views on religious thought could be tortured or cast out into the wilderness. And so the group that came here, I think they were pretty quintessentially and prototypically American, because they wanted to do their own thing.
Although their religious beliefs were not far off from the other colonists.
They were definitely Puritans, but they were not extremists like the Winthrop governance that had, you know, come to power in Boston.
The book is inspired by the story of this young man that ended up graduating from Harvard College, but the main character of the book is actually a young woman who was a colonist. Tell me a little bit about Bethia.
Yeah, well, I wanted to have a first-person narrator to tell the story, and it seemed to me that an English girl growing up in Great Harbor would have a very interesting view on her culture versus the Native American culture, which she couldn't help but be curious about. And so I imagined a friendship between Bithaya and Caleb when they're both children.
And you have a reading selected from when these two young people first meet. Would you read that for us?
Sure. I needed to do the chore I had been sent out for, to gather sufficient clams for our chowder kettle. So when I had put some distance between myself and the beach, I tied Speckle to a great piece of driftwood, unfastened the rake from the saddle, hitched my skirt high, and waded into the brine. It soon proved a poor place, and my rake was uncovering few shellfish worth placing in my basket. I was about to give up and try another spot when I felt eyes upon me. I straightened and turned and saw him for the first time, the boy we now call Caleb. He was standing in a thicket of tall beech grass, his bow slung over one shoulder, and some kind of dead waterfowl in a bag at his back. Something, perhaps the expression on my face, perhaps my frantic tugging at my skirt, which unfurled into the water to preserve my modesty at the cost of being soaked entirely, amused him, for he smiled. He was, I judged, and it later proved, a youth of my own age. He was clad for hunting, wearing a kind of deerskin breech clout tied with a belt fashioned of snakeskins. To this was laced a pair of hide leggings. Around his upper arms were twines of beadwork. All else about him was open and naked, save for three glossy feathers tied into a sort of topknot in his thick, jetty hair, which was very long, the forelock pulled hard back from his coppery face and bound up as one might dress a horse's mane. His smile was unguarded, his teeth very fine and white, and something in his expression made it impossible to fear him. Still, I thought it prudent to retrieve my mare and get away from this place, which seemed to be teeming with salvages of one sort or another. Who could say what outlandish person might next appear? I gathered up my soaking skirt and made for the shoreline. Unfortunately, in my haste, I caught my toe in a thicket of eelgrass and tripped into the water, spilling the few clams I'd gathered and soaking my sleeves and bodice to match my sodden skirt. He was beside me in a few long strides, a hard brown grip on my forearm as he pulled me out of the water. In his own language, I asked him to let go. His hand dropped from my arm. I made my way, dripping, to shore. He stood where he was, fixed to the spot by his own astonishment. It was my turn then to struggle against a smile. I think it would not have surprised him more had my horse addressed him.
Geraldine Brooks reading from her book Caleb's Crossing, the moment when two of the main characters in the book, Bithaya, a young woman, colonist, a Puritan, meets this young man from the wilderness. And they're both about 12 years old when they first meet.
That's right. And they forge a secret bond of friendship. At first, quite reluctantly. They're very different people. They have totally different idea about the world and their place in it and what is godly and good. And yet they're drawn together by this one thing they have in common, which is the desire to pursue knowledge. And both of them are willing to take great risks to themselves in order to do that.
And let's talk a little bit more about Bithaya, this young woman, because she had this strong desire to learn, and she had already, at the age of 12, learned a great deal, but she'd had to do it covertly.
She does. You know, the Puritans wanted their girls to learn to read because it was thought to be a very good thing if a mother could read her Bible to her children. But everything else was really out. They didn't want women to write because writing was a skill that you need to communicate with the world outside the family. And why would any good Puritan wife need to do that? Your husband communicates with the world. Your sphere is domestic. They also felt that higher study could addle a woman's wits and make her an unfit wife, because if she went and to her husband knowing more than he did about anything at all, that could lead to an unhappy marriage. So women's educational opportunities were sadly scant. And And so I imagined Bethaya based on women that I knew when I was a news correspondent in some of the more repressive parts of the Islamic world. And I particularly thought about a young girl in Afghanistan who'd been banned from going to school under the Taliban. And so she used to climb up onto the roof of her house and overhear the classes that were going on in the madrasa next door. And so I imagined Bethaya overhearing as her father, the minister, tries to learn the Wampanoag native language, and as her brother is struggling to learn Latin so that he can go off to Harvard when the time comes. And she wants this education, but it's completely out of the question that she'll get it other than by a sort of Promethean attempt to steal fire.
In describing how you were inspired by women you encountered in real life, I mean, we know that at that time there had to be very bright women who thirsted for knowledge and had the desire to learn, the need to learn, no matter what their circumstances were. But this is a time that's not particularly well documented. In doing your research, were you able to find women from that time that also inspired this character?
Well, there are a few notable women. Anne Bradstreet, the first published poet in North America, and she had an exceptional education because her father wanted her educated. And so, you know, she could write beautifully and wrote very eloquently about, you know, women's place in society, about which she was not at all happy. And then otherwise you find women's voices in court records where there's verbatim transcript, and women who are being hauled into religious courts to, you know, account for why they were transgressing. And one of the common things that they were charged with was being a scold, which meant that they'd been overheard criticizing a man in public. So I'm very glad that one's not still on the books, or I think I'd be in court myself.
I'm sure many, many of us would be.
Yeah.
As this story started to take hold of your imagination and these characters, and obviously inspired by reality, but of your creation, really, as this story began to take hold, what did you want to be able to show us about this world?
You know, I don't kind of characterize it that way. I think it's more, what does the story need to be? What story is going to unfold here? So, you know, the important thing to me is getting a voice in my head that I can hear very clearly from the past, somebody who'll talk to me and tell me how it was. And as she talks, that tells me what she's like, and what she's like tells me how she's going to act. And that drives the plot forward. So I don't really think about what am I telling the reader, because I think books tell you a different thing depending on when you come to them. You know, I often reread favorite books, and there'll be a different book with a different message depending on where I'm at in my own life.
Bethaya's voice is very strong, and she is the narrator throughout the book. It is told through her recollections. How did you master the language that she speaks in?
Basically by reading everything I could lay my hands on that was written on the vineyard in this time period. And even though there wasn't anything in a woman's voice except for some, you know, court records on the mainland, you know, it was astonishing to me to find that we don't have a journal by a woman from the colonial period until 1700, and no really detailed ones until 1750. So that's a whole 100 years later than my period. So, you know, I read court records to hear women and what they had to say and what preoccupied them. But for the voice and the language and the kind of words that people would have been likely to use, I relied on the letters and documents that were written by the English colonists. And luckily, we have those because a lot of the letters were to England, and most of what was saved is what was sent out of the colonies, because paper was so scarce here. People would write and rewrite and use the paper for all kinds of things. I couldn't believe how scant the Harvard 17th century archives were, and to my horror, I found out that the president of Harvard in the period that I was interested in, his papers were sent away to line bread trays at the local bakery because just, you know, getting their hands on any paper was just really hard.
As Caleb and Bethia become friends and explore each other's culture, she teaches him English. He teaches her his native language. She introduces her religion, and because he is training to be a spiritual leader of his people, she also learns about his religion, which gives you a beautiful opportunity and the reader a beautiful opportunity to explore some of the contrasts between the belief systems.
Yeah, and for that I was very lucky because there were some wonderful accounts of the difficulties that missionaries on Martha's Vineyard encountered when they were trying to sell the concept of Christianity to the indigenous people. And there's some wonderful, you know, the questions that were asked, they've taken careful note. And my favorite is an exchange about sin, and a young preacher called John Cotton is trying to convince the Wampanoag that they're sinners. And he said, you know, they had no ready concept of sin. This wasn't part of the way they thought about life. And they seemed much offended when I assured them that they had sinned, you know. And then he tries to tell them about original sin, and one of the men waves him away and says, it's a ridiculous story. Why would God make a garden for his children and then forbid them to eat its fruit? And even if this happened, why should he be angry with me about it when I only heard about it today?
And of course, that exchange does make it into exchanges between Bethia and Caleb as she is trying, as a very young woman, to explain her very strong beliefs. And as she comes to respect his beliefs, of course, it doesn't really change her beliefs. This is puritanical society, after all. So the belief system is extremely strong and unwavering.
Yeah, but she has it puts questions into her mind. She sees how the Wampanoag are much less materialistic. They give away their possessions in the confident expectation that their needs are going to be met, and she finds that extraordinarily Christian in them, whereas the English sort of surround themselves with their things and material possessions are very important to them. So, you know, she has to question what she's being told and what she sees, and finds that there's often a strong disjunction there.
I was struck by the way that although the Puritans were very strong in their Christian faith, they believed that the holy people of the natives were capable of performing supernatural acts, which seems like a conflict.
They were tremendously superstitious. This surprised me too. I hadn't been quite aware. I mean, they were superstitious in their own life. If they saw a chicken with a crooked leg, that meant the day was going to go badly. And you had to sow your peas at this or that phase of the moon. You know, this is still the medieval mindset is still very strong here. The modern mind, the scientific mind, hasn't really taken hold. So they do believe that the Indians can channel supernatural powers, and their explanation of it is that, you know, it's using the power of the devil, and that, you know, that the devil has his hand on these people, and that it's their role to, you know, bring right thinking and to introduce them to, you know, the proper concepts of God. So there was a tremendous amount of cultural destruction that took place. Even though the motives, you could say, were good motives, the effect was terrible in what it led to in terms of the fierce enmity to the traditional Wampanoag belief system.
I'm talking with Geraldine Brooks, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist. Her most recent novel, Caleb's Crossing, is now out in paperback, and she'll be in Iowa City tomorrow evening at the Iowa City Public Library, a guest of Prairie Lights Bookstore as well, tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a few minutes. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today, it's Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Geraldine Brooks. She'll be coming to Iowa City tomorrow evening at the Iowa City Public Library at 7 o'clock as a guest of the Iowa City Public Library and Prairie Lights Bookstore. She is with me now. We're talking about her latest novel, Caleb's Crossing, which is now out in paperback. And this novel was inspired by the story of the first Native American to graduate from Harvard College, which happened way back in 1665. And Geraldine, I say inspired by the story, but there's very little information about this man available anywhere.
It's really, you know, just too bad. The tribe obviously have always treasured his memory and treasured his achievement. In fact, some of my younger friends in the tribe say, oh, Caleb, you know, our parents beat us up with Caleb all the time whenever we were slacking off on our homework. It'd always be, Caleb was graduating from Harvard in 1665, so get on with your work, you know. So, but outside of the tribe, he wasn't well known. And when I started to do the research, sadly, you know, we know the bare bones that he was identified as a likely scholar by the minister here on the island who taught Native American children their letters, and the Wampanoag were very keen to embrace literacy. They saw that that was a very vital skill for them. And then he was sent away to a prep school in Cambridge and managed to matriculate to Harvard. So he was a member of a considerable elite, you know, the sons of the governor and the leading military officer and the most renowned ministers of the time were the only ones who could make it to Harvard, where all the instruction was carried out in Latin and with a very rigorous classical education. And we know that he graduated, and we know that he was something of a protege of Thomas Danforth, who was a famous magistrate of the colony. But apart from that, what it was like to be him, what it felt like to make that huge transition across the cultural divide, lost to us.
You mentioned some of your young friends among the Wampanoag. Have you spent a lot of time with them to learn about their culture for this novel?
Yes, and, you know, fortunately, the tribe on the island are just magnificent stewards of their culture and history, and there are wonderful oral histories that were videotaped with some of the tribal elders, and a great deal of information has been gathered together, reclaiming, really, the truth about the tribe, which was more or less suppressed for a number of years by cultural forces that, you know, came after. The characters in my book don't know that the future is going to be so bleak between the two people, because that hasn't really happened yet. There's still a chance that the two communities might find a way of living side by side on the land without all the dispossession and bloodshed that we know actually occurred. So I had to put myself in their mindset. And a number of tribal elders were very, very helpful to me in trying to recapture some of that history of the tribe before things like debt peonage and indenture alienated young tribal members from their own community. They were sent off on whaling ships or sent into service in English households. And for six generations, even the language was not spoken, but there's a remarkable program underway now, and the language is coming back to the tribe, which is terrific.
During the time period that you write about in the novel, it does seem like Martha's Vineyard was a very special place, and mainly by luck in some ways, where the relationship between the native people and the colonists was not great, but significantly better than what was going on the mainland.
Exactly. It never came to blows here. Nobody took up arms against each other. And even though the effect of the English coming was devastating in terms of disease, and in terms of the imposition of a completely different economic system in which the Wampanoag didn't fare so very well, it wasn't the horrible tale of the mainland, even though many of the figures who turned out to be significant in the wars of dispossession that followed had vineyard connections. Their attitudes did not prevail here.
Have the Wampanoag always been able to be on their own land? Have the native people been able to stay on the island?
Yeah, they have significant tribal lands, and the whole area of Aquinna is very much sort of the main home of the Wampanoag these days. Of course, you know, at the time period I'm talking about, they dominated all over the island. And Caleb was actually the son of the Songkem, or clan leader of the town that's now Vineyard Haven, which is where the ferry boats come in. So, and yes, there are Wampanoag who live there, but most of the cultural and connections with tribal lands are the Aquinna area of the island, which is the most beautiful area, in my opinion.
You talked about how Caleb is still someone who the Wampanoag talk of frequently and is held up as an example, although he lived so very long ago. When you first started talking about the idea of writing a novel that featured him, how did the Wampanoag respond to that? I mean, he's obviously almost a sacred figure for them.
Yeah, I think, you know, the attitudes varied quite a bit. Some people thought it was a great idea to bring attention to, you know, this very non-stereotypical Native American story. We don't often think about Native Americans as significant early intellectuals speaking in Latin and Greek and holding their own in the councils of the colonial elite in this way. So many tribal members were encouraging. Some were absolutely against it, and they just felt that it was wrong to take the life of somebody who actually lived and about whom we know so little, and then make up a story, essentially. They just felt that the whole undertaking was misguided. And I respect that opinion, obviously. I don't agree with it, because that's what I do, is try and use an empathetic imagination to bring people from the past back into the light of consideration today.
How have they responded to the book since its publication?
Most people have been very happy about it. There have been certain back and forth about the way certain events are portrayed, and we've had a really lively discussion between the tribe and in public forums, which have been very lively and frank, and a great exchange of views about, you know, there are real issues involved, you know, when somebody who is not from that culture presumes to write about it. And so we've, you know, really had a lot of interesting discussions hashing this out.
When I read your novels, they are the kind of thing that sort of sucks you into the world of the novel. You get very deeply immersed in it, and occasionally it's kind of jarring when you stop reading and have to deal with something in the real world. When you're writing it, does that happen to you?
Yes, you know, I have two school-age boys, and I find myself sometimes, you know, if they interrupt me when I'm working, I talk to them in 17th century language. They were playing lacrosse in the house, which I have a rule, and I feel it is a reasonable rule that you should not play lacrosse in the house. And so I was yelling at them, "You're vexing me with your ungirt behavior."
And that was not purposeful. That was on accident.
It just kind of pops out. You know, you're so immersed in that world. You're so down the rabbit hole. And the look on their face was just terrific.
I'm sure they've heard things like that from you before. You write, though, surrounded by technology, don't you? I mean, what's your environment like?
I'm in a very old room. I'm sitting in my study, which has hand-hewn beams. It was this part of the house was probably built in 1720. And I'm sitting, you know, looking out at an old elm tree and writing on a tavern table from the 18th century. So, you know, I walk the walk here.
And do you compose on a computer?
I do. I've got an Apple. I'm, you know, embarrassed to say, like everybody else.
You weren't writing with a quill pen.
No, ma'am. Have you ever tried to write with a quill pen?
Only one that I've made myself, which is not...
Well, everyone made them themselves. So, you know, you made your own pen. You went out and you picked up any kind of sturdy flight feather that you could find. And what you didn't do was leave all the feather on it. You would take all the feathery bits, the nice-looking bits, away and shear off the end of it. And so when you see people in a film with a great big plume, that's BS. They didn't have a plume. They had a feather pared down to practically nothing.
Spoken like a woman who has given this a try.
Yeah, it's really, really hard. That's why it's so hard to read those documents. I feel much more sympathetic now with the terrible handwriting.
As you dug into the history of Harvard College at this time, you mentioned that there aren't a lot of archives left because paper was at such a premium. But as you did try to research about Caleb, and he also had another classmate, a Native American classmate.
He did, Joel Iyer Coombs, who was the son of the first convert to Christianity from among the Wampanoag on the island. And he completed his requirements for the degree, too. But a misadventure overtook him when he was on his way back for the commencement. So he wasn't awarded his degree with Caleb, as he should have been. And last year, a very happy occasion, a young woman from the Wampanoag tribe of Gayhead Aquinna was graduating from Harvard College, the first to graduate from the college since Caleb from the island. Her name was Tiffany Smalley. And Harvard used that occasion to award Joel a posthumous degree. So he was belatedly welcomed into the Society of Educated People.
So Joel and Caleb accomplished the same thing, although Joel died before he was able to accept his diploma. Was he also held up as a role model to the young children of the tribe?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, it's Caleb and Joel, Joel and Caleb. And, you know, the Wampanoag speak of them with such affection and such vividness, you almost expect them to come wandering into the room. It's they're still, you know, very much alive in the mind of the tribe.
In your afterword to the book, you cite some of the sources that you used as you were doing your research. You also talk about how they're not particularly trustworthy because of the deep-seated racism of the time.
Oh, it's maddening. You know, the principal source on early Harvard is Samuel Eliot Morison, who just leaves out great chunks of quotes just to make the Indian experience look like a failure. So he's entirely unreliable on this. But going back to the original documents, I was able to piece it together in a more honest way. The other thing is that Morison hates women too, so I found myself getting really deeply etched frown lines as I read his work. But he does have useful information about what people actually studied and what they ate and how they got on with their lives, which is all terrific detail for a novelist.
There is one remaining piece of work from Caleb himself that you were able to find.
There's a beautiful letter that he wrote. It's a very graceful thank you note to the donors in England who were funding his education. And in it, he discusses the myth of Orpheus as it relates to his own situation.
And can you tell me more about what he said?
Well, you know, it's a very formal sort of thank you note, but it talks about Orpheus using music to bring the natural world alive, and he likens that to the experience of education and how an educated mind can bring the world more alive.
As I was reading the book, I couldn't help but feel that it was so unfair that these young men had to learn Greek and Hebrew and so many things that you think, how could that possibly have been useful to them once they graduated?
Well, you know, that was what an education was considered to be in those days, was a deep study of the thought of classical writers. And I don't think it's such a bad idea, actually. I mean, I'm a great fan of Horace and Homer, and I think that those stories are still the same stories that we're stealing today for, you know, our literary plots. And it's really a study of humanity is what they were undertaking at that time. And let's face it, we didn't really have a lot else to teach because science was still in its infancy. And you could learn what was known about astronomy in a couple of classes. So what they really looked at is what does it take to make a human being and how have human beings constructed their societies. And that's not so bad.
The end of this story is known. It's a piece of history, and that is that Caleb died merely a year or less than a year after he graduated from college.
Tragically, yes. And, you know, he wasn't alone in this. The death toll at that time was extraordinarily high. Diseases like tuberculosis were just endemic. And I think, you know, also for it was remarkable that Caleb and Joel withstood proximity to English for as long as they did without succumbing to diseases for which their immune systems weren't really conditioned.
Well, and there are so many tragedies that befall all of the characters in your book. Were you able to, in looking at what records we did have, did you find that that was a normal kind of life experience at that time?
Yeah, absolutely. And it would be mischaracterizing the times to make it any different, but death was just a constant for these people. I think that it's very hard, you know, as a historical novelist, there's a big question. Are we more alike or are we more different from people in different eras? And I think in most ways I tend to say we're very alike, that what motivates us, what shapes our consciousness is love and hatred and, you know, all kinds of desires that are the same for us as they were for them. But the one thing that is different is the constant death knell, the toll of the bell, which we, unless we live in some kind of extraordinarily violent times or places now, most of us bury people who are older than us. We very rarely have the experience of burying our young, but for them it was constant. It was very unusual for a family not to be burying some of the children at some point because of accident or because of just a lack of basic medical care or no antibiotics. You know, people were just carried off all the time.
Your last book, People of the Book, took your characters all over the world and took you all over the world as you researched it. This book was inspired by Martha's Vineyard, where you live, so it kept you much closer to home. Are you already engrossed in another history for your next novel?
Yes, I'm poking around in the past again and waiting for somebody to talk to me.
Can you give us a hint?
I'll give you a hint. They'll have to talk to me in Hebrew.
Okay. And your boys will probably hear a lot of that while you're writing the next novel, then.
Yes, I haven't got any good Hebrew vocabulary for cursing children yet, but I'm sure I'll come up with some.
Geraldine, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity. It's been great to be with you.
Geraldine Brooks, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist. Her latest book is Caleb's Crossing. It is now out in paperback, and she will be in Iowa City tomorrow evening at the Iowa City Public Library, a guest of the Public Library and Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. That's tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. And, of course, you can find out more about her and her books on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, Word Maven Patricia O'Connor will be here. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.